From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Over the past few weeks, some news organizations have reported a disturbing trend. They say they've been denied access to beaches near and the airspace over the Gulf oil spill, denied access by British Petroleum employees. BP is, of course, the company responsible for the spill. A CBS News crew trying to reach an oil-soaked beach taped an incident documenting the problem. Near the end of the clip, you hear a faraway voice saying, "This is BP's rules, not ours."
When we tried to reach the beach, a boat of BP contractors with two Coast Guard officers on board told us to turn around under threat of arrest.
This is BP's rules, not ours.
Just the suggestion that BP is making decisions about the movements of journalists caused an outcry, and by midweek, the Coast Guard had stepped in to clarify its media policy and to reiterate that BP is definitely not making the rules. But by that point, a few journalists had already been running in circles, including Times-Picayune photojournalist Ted Jackson, trying to do a routine flyover. Jackson had hired a seaplane to get aerial shots of the spill.
Typically, you call the FAA and request permission to get below the temporary flight restriction, and the flight restriction that day was 3,000 feet, which is way too high to make a picture. So we requested to be able to fly lower than that, and the authority asked who was on the flight, and he said, "I have the Times-Picayune photographer," and the answer was immediately no, then. You cannot have this exemption. The seaplane company owner asked him, "Can I get your name so I can put your name in the file of people who are denying this request?" He told him his name, and he said that he was a BP contractor hired to handle aviation requests. And that was just very disturbing to think that I was being denied access from a BP representative.
Now, for a newspaper to invest in the kind of seaplane and boat rides isn't nothing. Are you getting to the point where some of these wild goose chases are going to limit the amount of journalism you can do?
Well, that's exactly what's happening. You're spending $1,500 for a seaplane or a helicopter to fly 2.5 hours or 3 hours or whatever it takes, and you get there and you're turned around. You just can't afford to do that day after day after day. And so you just quit taking those flights.
Have you heard similar stories from colleagues?
The Associated Press has had problems. CBS, I understand, had problems getting to sites.
I know the Coast Guard has been trying to take some reporters and photographers to the scene. Have you participated in any of these excursions?
Yes, we've done several of those flights. And those are great because it gives you the access. You don't want to turn down an opportunity. But I kind of liken that to going to Paris and shooting your pictures out the tour bus window. It's just not the way to do journalism. You don't get to investigate. You don't get to get off the beaten path and to see what's really out there.
You didn't get the sense they were propaganda tours, that they were showing you what they wanted you to see and hiding from you what they didn't?
I didn't get the sense of that. I try not to see the world that way. But at the same time, I know that I'm not being able to visually ask the questions that I want to ask. A good example of that was just the other day when I went on the airboat tour to a cleanup site. And through no fault of the Coast Guard, I mean, they organized it very well. They got us on the boat. And once there, it was very difficult to get the boat driver to position into an area that I needed the picture because he wasn't working for me. He was working for BP.
Now, we're speaking on Thursday. You say that as of Wednesday, things seem to have changed.
Correct. We are now able to fly at a 1,500-foot ceiling instead of 3,000. Which is a huge difference. And I think if we made a request in the air to go lower, I think the decision would be made on a case-by-case basis if it was safe or not. And we're fine with that. We just don't want to be summarily dismissed because we're media.
All right, Ted. Many thanks.
Thank you very much.
Ted Jackson is a photojournalist at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Lieutenant Commander Chris O'Neill is the Chief of Media Relations at the U.S. Coast Guard. I asked him what role the Coast Guard plays in granting access to reporters.
We have a leading role in the process. You have the Coast Guard that serves as the federal on-scene coordinator, ultimately responsible for making decisions. But those decisions get made in a collaborative environment where you have representation from the responsible party in this spill, which in this case is BP, You have the Coast Guard, and then you have representatives from state and local governments.
We spoke to a photographer from the Times-Picayune who told us that after a whole bevy of complaints from himself and his colleagues that things suddenly changed along around Wednesday. Is that your view of the situation, that there was a problem that got fixed?
I don't know if there was a problem that got fixed. I think we reiterated policy that had been clearly communicated, specifically reminding all parties involved in the response that the media shall at all times be afforded access to response operations and shall only be asked to leave an area when their presence is in violation of an existing law or regulation or clearly violates the written site safety plan or their presence interferes with effective operations. We tell people specific steps they have to take when they encounter that kind of situation. For example, if the presence violates a part of the site safety plan, the worker is required to tell the media how they might remedy this situation without having to depart. And it could be something as simple as putting on splash goggles or some other protective gear.
Well, I guess not everybody got the memo. We have the incident where the Times-Picayune reporter is told no because he's a journalist. He can't go below the 3,000-foot flight threshold.
Well, sure. There's not unlimited access, and that would be, frankly, unsafe and unproductive. Flight restrictions are in place for a number of reasons. One of the primary reasons was for the protection of the wildlife. There's also a matter of the conflicting airspace, so there have to be constraints.
Granted, there's been a limited number of untoward episodes reported, but I think it's fair to say that if people think that BP is in any way calling the shots on media access, that they would freak out, we would freak out.
I can absolutely assure you that the U.S. Coast Guard and the federal government are the ones setting media policy for the Deepwater Horizon response. I think these incidents that have been reported are isolated. They're unfortunate. They're regrettable. It leaves a bad taste in anybody's mouth. And that's certainly not the outcome we want. And I think the more than 500 or so media embeds and the coverage that the international community and the national community are seeing in the media of the event shows that we have a very proactive policy and are working very, very hard to embed as many media as possible.
Well, Chris, thank you very, very much.
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners today.
Lieutenant Commander Chris O'Neill is the Chief of Media Relations for the United States Coast Guard.
This week, U.S. intelligence announced that they killed al-Qaeda's number three operative, who goes under the nom de guerre Sheikh Saeed al-Masri, in a drone strike in Pakistan. Al-Qaeda's top two positions are filled, of course, by Osama bin Laden and his second-in-command Ayman al-Zawahiri, who have so far eluded the U.S., but the al-Qaeda hunters do have an impressive record of eliminating number three. In fact, according to the Washington Post, they've netted the third man 10 times. Recently, Slate columnist Tim Noah recalled that he first noticed this pattern back in 2005, after the Bush administration claimed credit for four number threes. What exactly is the deal with number three?
How many number three guys do they have? Is this like a corporation that has about 27 vice presidents? Or is this one of those jobs that they just can't seem to keep filled, like Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher at Hogwarts School or the drummer for Spinal Tap?
And who are they? Do they have anything in common?
I think that the number three job is a more operational job, so you're more vulnerable to attack. You know, it's not like bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. They're way at the top. They think about big picture stuff. But for like the number three guy, you think it's easy recruiting suicide bombers and planning terrorist operations. You're putting your neck on the line every day. So number three really looks to be kind of a lousy job.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Timothy Noah is a senior writer for Slate. Jarrett Brockman is an internationally recognized al-Qaeda specialist who says that the organization is not a strict hierarchy. There are several number threes, all of whom do different jobs. And though U.S. intelligence may have engaged in some rank inflation when it comes to those previous number threes, the latest, Sheikh Saeed al-Masri, was arguably the number one three.
He's been with Ayman al-Zawahiri, the guy who's actually running al-Qaeda, bin Laden's right-hand man, since the beginning, since the 80s in Egypt. So he was a gatekeeper, he was a financier, He was best friends with the guy in charge. So he was in a very powerful and dominant bureaucratic position.
He also served as something of a spokesperson, right?
Well, that's right. He hadn't until around May of 2007. Al-Qaeda trotted him out in their official media. But more importantly, he started engaging with mainstream Arab media. He conducted media interviews with Al Jazeera, with GOTV. These are organizations that Al-Qaeda does not typically work with anymore. You know, one of the things that I have kind of observed over the past few years is that Al-Qaeda has transformed from a terrorist organization that uses the media into a media organization that uses terrorism. Al-Qaeda realized it was constrained operationally, but that it could get other people to do its job for it if it could just rally them up enough.
And you've likened some of what they do to American Sunday morning chat shows like Meet the Press.
Well, exactly. If you think about the Al-Qaeda media network, it's very much like these Sunday talk shows, where at first you'll have the senior policymaker come out, the headliner. In our world, it would be the vice president. In their world, it would be Ayman al-Zawahiri. Sheikh Saeed was another one of these figures. And they would identify kind of the big policy statements. But then after they leave, the roundtable comes on, where you have pundits and commentators trying to make it accessible to the people who are watching. And Al-Qaeda has that cadre of people, too. But they tend to be much more systematic in how they try to translate what the big thinkers say down to something that resonates with the people.
Yeah, but that's not the job of Meet the Press.
Well, you know, it is to interpret and to dissect and to analyze and I think to hold the policymakers' feet to the fire.
I'd assume these Al-Qaeda pundits aren't holding the Al-Qaeda policymakers' feet to the fire, right?
In fact, some of them do. Some of them, I agree, are very sycophantic and kind of just pander. But others are very critical. In fact, one of these pundits criticized bin Laden on 9/11. And he said 9/11 would have been a success had Al-Qaeda done a couple other things right. So some of them are very critically minded, and they tend to be among the most popular. So, you know, I think Sheikh Saeed sat among the big policymakers, but he came under fire just as much as Zawahiri or bin Laden have from the public movement and from these pundits.
All right, Jared, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jared Brockman is a specialist on Al-Qaeda and the author of Global Jihadism, Theory and Practice.
Coming up, Israel and the flotilla seen through dueling videos.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As of Friday, all eyes were on an Irish aid ship heading toward the Gaza Strip. This comes after a confrontation on Monday in which the Israeli Defense Forces boarded a ship sponsored by a Turkish Islamic Aid organization carrying hundreds of activists. An incident that left 9 activists dead and proved to be a PR disaster for Israel, despite its efforts at damage control. The activists ensured the clash would get press attention by webcasting live video from the boat soon after the Israeli soldiers boarded. Afterwards, the IDF released its own clips. Their tape included images of activists wielding chairs against the soldiers. The cameras panned over clubs, knives, and slingshots the IDF claimed to have found on board. Without unedited tape from an impartial source, it's hard to tell what happened, but the ready availability of the video kept the story in the news cycle, as both cable and broadcast news ran the images again and again. Brian Stelter covers television and digital media for the New York Times. He says that while the video is confusing, one thing we can say for sure is that both sides display a keen awareness of their audience.
The flotilla of activists had constructed this media campaign in advance where they had basically created a webcast network of live pictures from multiple cameras on the boats, beamed up to the satellite, live on the internet to any TV network that wants it. So they were heading out onto the open sea with a media strategy, you know, from the beginning.
And presumably they didn't have these cameras set up just to film their voyage. Because who cares about the voyage, right? So it's in anticipation of some sort of confrontation, we can assume, can we not?
The degree to which they produced this event is notable. Also having spokespeople in other countries, not on the boats, able to be reached by the media at all times, certainly had an impact. On the other side of this, the Israeli Defense Forces had many cameras of their own, cameras on their helicopters, cameras with the soldiers, so they could present their side of the confrontation. Both sides pointed to video clips to try to prove that the other side was the aggressor. I think in this case, it ended up just making everything more murky.
the video is kind of inconclusive because it doesn't really give you context.
Yeah, if we were able to see unedited videos from each of these angles, maybe, and just maybe, we'd have a better sense of what happened and who was the aggressor. And by the way, it only gets worse when they add captions. At one point in the Israeli military videos, they add yellow circles around the weapons that they want you to see.
Some corroborating evidence or illuminating evidence should come from the journalists mm-hmm. who were aboard the ship. They were taken into custody.
Right. Al Jazeera had about 7 people in this flotilla covering this story, producers, reporters, and cameramen. One was able to be released almost immediately. The others were held for a longer period of time. There were also members of the press from Australia, from Bulgaria, from Turkey. Very little eyewitness reporting got out, though, before the Israeli military moved in and really put a blackout on information here. But one of the sole eyewitness accounts that actually came out, one that was able to be broadcast live, was from an Al Jazeera reporter who was saying that the white flag was being raised by the boat, and still there was live fire going on.
Tens of people, civilians, have been injured. There are still sounds of live fire despite the white flag being raised.
But even that clip was seized upon by people on the web, some bloggers who were trying to suggest that that clip, that one moment in time, that it means that the Israelis were the ones that attacked first. And there was no evidence of that in the actual video.
Isn't it just a Rorschach test for where you stand on Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians?
I think even when we do have these eyewitness accounts, they get twisted into different forms by the people on all sides of this anyway.
So if this is really about litigating in the court of public opinion, do you think the response to all of the inconclusiveness of the existing images will be for there to be fewer guys with guns and more guys with cameras? I mean, is this going to turn into some sort of Paddy Chayefsky mode of war where there are more videographers than soldiers?
Well, I think we're going to see a gradual increase in the video cameras in these conflicts, no doubt. But I remember an image that really struck me last year during the protests in Iran when we had people with camera phones posting onto YouTube through intermediaries. There was an image of, it may have been Neda, it may have been one of the other activists that was killed. I can't remember, to be
honest. Neda Aga Sultan, the young woman who was shot in the head.
I remember seeing someone laying on the ground, either wounded or killed, and no less than 5 or 6 camera phones out circling this person. It certainly humanizes what's happening in a way that still photographs or eyewitness accounts can never do. And I have to think that that has an impact on the public's perception of these conflicts. The danger, obviously, is that if we see these dramatic, almost painful images over and over and again, we get numb to them.
I'm curious, based on what you've seen so far of the video from both sides, do you have any confidence that you know what happened?
I have much less confidence than I did when I first read about it.
All right, Brian. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter covers television and digital media for the New York Times.
Much of the criticism of the IDF's handling of the flotilla was voiced within Israel itself, where debate over Israeli policies is often more robust than it is here. In a much-discussed essay in the New York Review of Books this month called The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, author and journalist Peter Beinart argues that groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, or the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, or the Anti-Defense League, squelch criticism on these shores by regarding critics of Israel as enemies of Israel. We asked Beinart and Stephen Rosen, the former director of foreign policy issues at AIPAC, to debate the issue. The focus is intentionally narrow. This is not a discussion of Israel's right to exist. Both Beinart and Rosen are Zionists. This is a debate about whether criticism endangers Israel's security. More fundamental for this program, it's an argument over whether honest debate ever poses a danger to a democracy. Both Beinart and Rosen do agree on 2 points. First, that criticism of Israel in American media is far more abundant than it used to be. And second, that criticism of Israel in the U.S. Congress is very rarely heard. Mostly I stayed out of it. Peter Beinart begins.
Not to single out AIPAC, but all of the major pro-Israel organizations say very explicitly that their support for Israel, their love of Israel, is not only because they are Jews and Israel is a Jewish state, but because Jews have created in Israel a liberal, democratic Jewish state. But if you say that's why you admire Israel, then it seems to me you have a responsibility to fight for those values, for Israel as a liberal democracy. And I think there are forces in Israel today, in the settlement movement, in Shas, the ultra-Orthodox Mizrahi party, that are hostile to liberal democratic values. And I think we who love Israel as a liberal democracy have to defend them.
But the problem here is there's only one actual Israel. When a person says, I'm pro-Israel, but I don't like the Israel that exists, there's this Israel in my mind that if only they would do all of the things that I say they should do, and then I will love them. They're talking about an imaginary world. There's an actual Israel, the only Israel. And that Israel is surrounded by enemies. And you're either going to try to help protect it, or you're going to jump on the bandwagon of those who are trying to harm it. There's only two camps here. And it's true that you could go to Israel and try to meet with the members of the Israeli government and persuade them to pursue the course of action that you think is appropriate. But you're arguing that that debate should be held in the United States Congress. The United States is Israel's only reliable ally. When you drive a wedge between the United States and Israel, you're weakening Israel. You're causing Israel profound harm.
I think it's mistaken to draw a bright line between Israelis who criticize their government and people outside the United States, particularly Jews. Because, in fact, I think the fate of those Israelis who want to create an open space for criticism is very dependent on our willingness outside of Israel to amplify their voices and be in solidarity with them. In fact, one of the things that worries me most about what this Israeli government has done is their campaign against human rights organizations and others that support criticism and an unvarnished look at Israelis' policies. We have a vice prime minister who called Peace Now, the anti-occupation group, a virus. We've had members of the Knesset of the ruling parties that have virtually called the New Israel Fund, and that funds a lot of Israeli human rights organizations, treasonous. Those people need our aid. They need our defense. If I don't have the right as an American Jew to amplify the voices of those Israeli Jews who share my values, then I think the fate of those Israeli Jews who want to create space in their society for criticism will be more imperiled. And I believe that I have that right, just as American Jews had the right to be critical of the Soviet Union when it was not allowing Jews to immigrate, just as American Jews had the right to protest about the genocide in Bosnia and that they do in Darfur. I see us, to some degree, all as part of a moral community in which we can have public concerns outside of our borders.
Well, I don't think this is a debate I can win to the NPR audience, but I never said, Peter, that you don't have the right to support the New Israel Fund, for example. If you want to send a contribution to the New Israel Fund, by all means do so. If you want to join an Israeli political party or write in an Israeli newspaper or even an American newspaper, go ahead. But if your point is that AIPAC and the Anti-Defamation League should join the crusade against Israel, which is the central point of your article, then I think you're on the wrong track, because they are part of the effort to strengthen Israel and to help Israel in a dangerous world. This is not about debates on university campuses. This is about the survival of Israel against an enormous coalition. You know, American even-handedness is not even-handed in its effects. The whole world is an automatic ally of the other side. Israel has one reliable ally. It's the United States. And when you erode the alliance between the United States and Israel, you're undermining Israel's security. It's not just about the policy you don't like. It's about the whole country, the stuff you do like and don't like equally. So it's the wrong approach. It's like sacrificing your child because they're drinking too much.
I see in what Stephen is saying a reflection partly of the generational divide that I was talking about in my piece, and I say this with great respect, but I just do not identify with this vision that he seems to have, in which the entire world is destined to hate Israel and Jews regardless of what Israel does, that it's basically somehow just in the soil, that we should assume that everybody who criticizes Israel, particularly every non-Jew, is doing so from a position of ill will. There's a bleakness, a pessimism to that, that I think is not in what I think of as the best Jewish traditions that animate dominate me and my life. Many people who criticize Israel, they believe, understandably, in a post-colonial world, that it is not just to keep control of large numbers of people who you don't give the right to vote. Rather than seeing those people as eternally hostile to Jews and Israel, we should be willing to listen to their criticisms. But the blanket assertion that everybody hates Israel and everybody always will, I think, is part of a bunker mentality that is making it harder for Israel to live out its best traditions.
Perhaps you haven't paid attention that in the last 25 years, since this older generation has faded, you've seen the growth of Islamic extremism on a global scale, much of it aimed at Israel. And they are not so much interested in the territories as such. They are interested in the very existence of Israel, as they openly state. So I don't see how you can dismiss the sea of hostility. It's in front of your face every day. It's not the professors at the Sorbonne, and it's not the New York Review of Books that we're talking about. It's Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran and Syria and Islamic extremists from one end of the globe to the other. So you're talking about a very deeply threatened country. It's not threatened because of one policy or another or the personality of Bibi Netanyahu or any other single thing. The pro-Israel organizations, I worked for one, AIPAC, for 23 years, I ought to know, see themselves as part of an activist effort to fight against that tidal wave.
If criticism lends support and comfort to Hezbollah and Hamas, does that mean that criticism itself becomes an existential issue?
I didn't argue once, Brooke, in this discussion against criticism. What I argued against repeatedly...
policies in the U.S. government, I understand that.
Exactly.
But you also did say that there are really only two sides. You're either supporting Israel or you've joined the caravan of people who are against them.
Well, it is true that when you write an article like Peter's, which just piles on criticism and barely mentions the threats to Israel, it hardly mentions Hamas, Iran, the world consists, as he tells it, of Israeli sins, which he recites very passionately. He's extremely eloquent. May there be intellectual merit in point number 7 or point number 11? Probably here and there, yeah. But you're not building Zionism, as he says in his article, you're eroding it. Does it mean that you don't have the right in a democracy to say these things? No. But you don't have the right to call it pro-Israel activity. That it is not. The last 2 weeks, Peter, Israel's been under assault, and you've been on the radio reciting what's wrong with Israel. The last 2 weeks were the acid test, the rainy day, a day in which, yes, there are questions about whether Israel handled the boarding of this ship properly. And people who say their friends have to be there on a rainy day, not just on a sunny day, not just if Israel does everything perfectly and lives up to your golden shining Israel on the hill in your imagination, but on days when Israel's imperfect, you have to be there. And if you're not going to be there when the going gets rough, then don't call yourself a friend.
I can be there if I believe that Israel is badly hurting itself, just like I had the right to be there when I thought the United States was badly hurting itself during much of the Bush-Cheney period. You can say that I'm a utopian to believe that Israel should not be in the business of creating a situation in which 80% of the people in Gaza are in food aid, that it's utopian to believe that Israel can be secure. I don't believe that's utopian. If that's utopian, then the people who created the state of Israel were utopian, because that was not the vision that they had of what the Jewish state would be, and I don't believe that it's the vision that we have to settle for today.
I don't hear you talking about Israel facing a security dilemma, the dilemma of 3,000 rockets and the danger that far more potent and more accurate and larger warheads will get there that will threaten Israel's major cities. I don't think just filling the airwaves with more criticism of Israel contributes one thing. By the way, a point that I didn't make earlier, you talk about people whose voices are silenced. At the typical American university, a friend of Israel will find it very difficult to get tenure in the political science department. A friend of Israel is looked at someone suspect outside the community of values. And in any place where the intellectual elites congregate, friendship toward Israel is not well regarded. I doubt that there are very many staff members at National Public Radio who are stand-up friends of Israel, because it's not popular in these environments. The real imbalance is an unwillingness to hear the pro-Israel voice. That's the real problem.
But Steve, the problem is you're defining pro-Israel as only people who won't be publicly critical. And when you define it that way, yes, you are going to find that pro-Israel voices, as you define them, are very rare on university campuses and other places. But if you define pro-Israel in a more generous way, just as I would define pro-American as people who are very, very upset about certain policies of American governments, then the balance of forces looks very, very different. I think you are self-perpetuating this cycle of victimology, everybody is against us, by not being generous in your interpretation of those people who genuinely do want Israel to exist, indeed even thrive and prosper as a Jewish state, but believe its own policies are harmful in that effort. By your definition, I also am part of this sea of people who are anti-Israel. That just has no meaning for me, given the values with which I was raised, given the connection to Israel that I feel and that I will plan to instill in my children. It's kind of insulting.
Well, we're going around in circles. I don't see how you devote 90% of your time to what's wrong with Israel. You minimize the threat to Israel. You describe Israel's leaders as nearly demonic people. And then at the end of it, you say, I'm a great friend of Israel. I just don't get it.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Stephen Rosen is director of the Washington Project at the Middle East Forum, a think tank in Washington, D.C. And Peter Beinart, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Peter Beinart is an author, most recently of The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. His essay, The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, is in the June 10th issue of the New York Review of Books.
Coming up, two revolutionary ways to tell the story of war.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. More information at cityyear.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 1959, a reporter named Cornelius Ryan published The Longest Day. That day was June 6, 1944, the invasion of Normandy, known as D-Day. The book, an immediate success that sold millions of copies around the world, was soon overshadowed by its Hollywood adaptation, starring Richard Burton, Sean Connery, Robert Mitchum, Rod Steiger, Henry Fonda, and inevitably, John Wayne.
Do you read me?
Loud and clear, sir.
All right. One more thing. Your assignment tonight is strategic. You can't give the enemy a break. Send him to hell.
In the Columbia Journalism Review this month, author Michael Shapiro argues that Cornelius Ryan's book, now largely forgotten, was nothing short of revolutionary. It was, he said, one of the first modern examples of literary nonfiction and a flat-out triumph of diligent reporting.
Now, we're talking about the Allied invasion of occupied France. There was a lot of people involved.
And he interviewed
hundreds upon hundreds of people. But remember, this begins in the mid-1950s. You cannot Google names. You cannot put in a search for D-Day survivors. So he starts putting ads in newspapers and magazines and trade journals around the world saying, if you were there, get in touch. And people get in touch. Americans, British, Canadian, German. And what he begins to do is methodically, and I cannot underscore that word enough, methodically ask people, first with a questionnaire that he sent out to them, and then sitting down with them one by one, or with his assistants one by one if he didn't speak the language, what did you do that day? Were you ever injured? Were you ever shot? Did it hurt? Now we look at this and go, well, everybody does that. I mean, you reconstruct a scene in journalism. That's sort of part and parcel of what we do all the time. Not back then.
Let's roll back a little bit here. And let's start, first of all, with that day, June 6, 1944. At the time, Ryan was a newspaper journalist who was covering the war for the Daily Telegraph in London. You wrote that he went to D-Day twice?
First he flies over, then he flies back to England. And as soon as he gets back to England, he gets on a boat and he sails back. So he is literally at Normandy twice that day. He had just turned 24. And what he discovered is the story of his life, the beginning of the end of the war in Europe. And he goes back to a life as a reporter, eventually becomes a magazine writer, eventually moves to New York.
So around 1957, 13 years after that day, he gets the idea to reconstruct it almost hour by hour, if he can.
I think the only analogy that comes to mind when you think about this kind of reporting is imagining filling a 55-gallon drum with an eyedropper. There is no fast way to do this.
I know that you brought some of his questionnaires here.
Yeah. I picked one out of random here. This is from a man named John F. Dolligan, who, if his relatives are listening, he was in the 2nd Battalion of the 26th Infantry of the 1st U.S. Infantry Division. And he was at D-Day as a captain. And Ryan asked questions like, what time did you land? What was it like on the landing craft going over? Did you have any friends who died? Do you recall any incident, such as sad or heroic or simply memorable, which struck you more than anything else?
How did he respond?
The beach, he responds with an exclamation mark. It was a mess. Landing craft were hung up on the underwater obstacles. Some of the craft were burning. A big craft was in roaring flames and exploding. The exits to the beach were blocked. And it goes on and on and on. But even better, do you remember anything that seems funny now? You'd think, why would you ask this question? Even though it did not, of course, seem amusing at the time, we were packed in tight and huddled in a crouch below the ramp on the sides of the landing craft. Several men were sick on the way into the beach. One boy who was getting splashed from behind growled, use the goddamn, he writes, GD bag. Someone growled, the GD bag is full. Everyone laughed and, he underlines this several times, relaxed.
Wow. That is gold for a journalist.
And you know what? This is not in the book. He had so much stuff, he didn't even need this.
Well, as you wrote in your article, it was, what, some 1,480 people got in touch with him.
Yeah.
And probably one of the richest veins from which he drew was the aide to Field Marshal Rommel himself.
That's right. One of the interesting questions was, how'd they win? Had the Allies win that day? Because it was by no means a sure thing that was going to happen. And the Germans had their most decorated field leader, Erwin Rommel, the hero of North Africa, in charge of the defenses, except Rommel wasn't there that day.
Now, Ryan got a lot of very detailed information from that aide, Helmut Lang, including a description of Rommel's office in a castle in Normandy. And Ryan used that information to set the scene for one of the early chapters. Could you read from it?
Sure. In the ground floor room he used as an office, Rommel was alone. He sat behind a massive Renaissance desk, working by the light of a single desk lamp. The room was large and high-ceilinged. Along one wall stretched a faded Gobelin tapestry. On another, the haughty face of Duke François de la Rochambeau looked down out of a heavy gold frame. There were a few chairs casually placed on the highly polished parquet floor and thick draperies at the windows, but little else.
That could almost be a crime scene report.
It could either be a crime scene report or the beginning of a Gothic novel. Every detail here is earned.
You note that Ryan was instrumental in adapting the screenplay for
yes.
the blockbuster film. Do you have a favorite scene?
There's a character named Dutch Schultz who is on the boat coming across the English Channel.
Dutch Schultz the mobster?
No, Dutch Schultz the guy. And he has all this money. He's been winning poker at this spectacular rate. And he decides that if he has all this money, he's going to die. He's going to get killed. And so what he does is he sits down and goes, how long is it going to take me to lose all this money?
How'd you make out?
Huh?
How'd you finally make out in the game?
I lost.
Oh, we're both jumping clean.
The movie is quite faithful to the book. Obviously, Ryan, having worked on the screenplay, makes it so. It's a series of connected set pieces, set piece after set piece after set piece. All these little dramas are happening, and there's a great inexorable wave carrying all these forces to the same place. He has a great, great sense of tempo, back and forth, big, small, general, foot soldier, American, British, German, French resistance, back and forth, because you know what's going to happen at the end. And yet, you get very quickly caught up in the narrative.
And you end your piece with a seeming visit to his graveside.
The reason I wrote the piece is that this was the first grown-up book I ever read. And I spoke to the curator of the Ryan Collection, which is at Ohio University. And he said, by the way, you know, his tombstone says...
reporter.
And I said, I have to check. And here's the difference between 1957 and 2010. I could Google it.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Shapiro is a professor at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and author most recently of Bottom of the Ninth, Branch Rickey, Casey Stengel, and the Daring Scheme to Save Baseball from Itself. Effectively depicting the violence and corruption around the war on drugs and the Mexican-U.S. drug trade is no easy task, even for those steeped in its ins and outs. For well over a decade, Charles Bowden has been covering North America's unofficial capital of drug violence, the Mexico border city Juarez. Bowden's latest work, Dreamland, The Way Out of Juarez, takes a hybrid approach to convey the futility and the carnage, using reportage, poetic language, transcripts from police interviews, and woven throughout, medieval-looking illustrations by Texas-based artist Alice Leora Briggs. Taken together, it has the impact of a fever dream. At one point, Bowden writes, "The state persists just as astrology persists and many things persist, but the state has become a shadow on the wall that pretends to be in charge. The order now comes from the streets, and it is unruly but regular, unfair but as certain as a killing frost, and everyone decides this is the way it has always been." Bowden goes on,
"Something. Whiff of hellfire or of heaven, something of the future already arrived in the small condo on the side street in the city that causes fear to the heart, the city that cannot be discussed or examined, the city with dust in the air and men and women in the ground."
That small condo was the scene of many horrific murders, and Bowden says that when the story of the condo broke in early 2004, it was one of the first times the uncontained violence of Juarez was publicly acknowledged. By focusing on this one condo, Bowden tries to tell the story of the whole city, a city, he says, that's dying.
"An estimated 100,000 to 400,000 people have fled it in the last 18 months. 25% of the houses have been abandoned. 100,000 jobs have been lost. 40% of the businesses have closed. The city is dying. Violence isn't an incident anymore. It's the actual fabric of life. It's part of basic transactions there. Last Friday, 15 people were slaughtered in Juarez. This goes on every day. This book is about a house in Juarez. They would take people there, torture them, execute them, and then they would bury them in the backyard and pour lime on them so they would decay swiftly. In a four-month period, they put 14 people in that back patio."
Describe what the death house was that you've built so much of your book around.
The death house was a very nice condo in a middle-class neighborhood, six blocks from a sushi parlor in a high-end hotel. It was used by the Juarez cartel as a killing ground. These houses are all over the city. The drug organizations always have deals with legitimate government, and part of the deal is not to embarrass the legitimate government, and so they disappear bodies. This house is simply a tactic to vanish people. In 2008, two more houses came to public notice. One of them had 9 corpses in it. Another one had 35. But they're all over the city. I have maps of some of them drawn for me by cartel members. These people will never be excavated. It will never be acknowledged.
The point here seems to be one of relentless, inevitable injustice.
And corruption. In this case, The executions were done by state policemen who were hired by the drug organization in Juarez to do the killing. This is common. I have interviewed a professional killer, a sicario, who has killed hundreds of people there. But in fact, he was a comandante in the Mexican state police in Chihuahua in charge of their anti-kidnapping unit. Part of what you're seeing on the border is a mutual fantasy or fraud perpetrated by both governments. On the U.S. side, and these agencies are slowly being corrupted, and they're being corrupted because the money's so big. I've interviewed gang leaders in Juarez, and I'd say, how do you move drugs to El Paso? And they'd say, well, we use the Border Patrol and the U.S. Army. I've interviewed cartel members, and I said, don't you ever worry about DEA and the FBI? And they'd say, no, we have people in there. Now, I don't think these stories are false, and certainly nobody in DEA has any trouble believing them, but they are buried. Nobody will talk about them out loud.
But why wouldn't reporters want to tell a story like this?
There's two hindrances to the U.S. press. One, there can be an element of danger messing around the border. Secondly, it is far easier to take in a statement from an agency or a public official than to go investigate it. They take the easy way out. I mean, I have been baffled for over 20 years by one of the biggest stories in my country is underreported, both the explosion of drug money and the explosion of human beings. Mexico is collapsing. This is an exodus of human beings. This is a far more significant event for the future of the United States than the war in Iraq.
Now explain to me why you chose to take Alice Leora Briggs up on her suggestion that she illuminate this manuscript, almost like a medieval text.
When I agreed to do this with Alice Leora Briggs, I had never met her. She had sent me a CD with some of her drawings, and I looked at them, and what I thought instantly was, this person understands pain. I didn't want someone that would illustrate what I wrote, meaning I describe an execution, there's a drawing of an execution. I wanted somebody who knew enough about life that they could capture the horror of what was going on. And so I went with her. And frankly, when this whole thing started, Alice had never been to Juarez. She went down there for about 8 months living on the line. But I feel my instincts were sound, that Alice brought the dead back, and now she makes the rest of us face what we've turned our backs on and have pretended isn't happening.
You wrote this book like a reporter traumatized by what he knows, but can't write the way he'd like to write it. What was your frame of mind when you wrote Dreamland?
I wrote Dreamland in a fury, and the fury was at the American press and the U.S. government. I've been trying to leave the border for years because it's damaging to me, because I'm tired of dead people, but I haven't been able to make it. I actually am, by some standards, a normal person. I feed birds. I garden. I like to cook. I don't need corpses. But what keeps bringing me back is the way I was raised, you can't know this kind of slaughter is going on. You can't know that the destruction of a people is going on and pretend it's not happening. When I wrote it, I hoped it would, you know, like get the demons out of my life. I guess you could say it was therapy on my part. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but it was a nice stab at it.
I have to say I felt very shaken reading Dreamland. Now I can't read any stories about apprehended drug lords or recovered bodies in the same way. I do feel like if I haven't been down there, that your evocative prose has pushed my face into it, into the hopelessness. Was that your goal?
My dream is to invite a reader into a room and pour a nice cup of tea and then nail the damn door shut. I want them to look at a 40-year war of drugs that has created a police state in the United States, the largest prison population per capita on Earth, and slaughtered tens of thousands of Mexicans. I want them to taste it, not just read some policy statement. And that's why it's disturbing, because I want people to be disturbed. It seems to me it's the only way things are ever going to change.
Do you consider Dreamland journalism?
I don't know. You know, I used to be a straight reporter. I worked for a Gannett newspaper. I've won a bunch of awards. I periodically revert and write what you'd call straight stuff. But I don't know if this is journalism reporting or anything else. I know it is true. And I used whatever skills I have to make you not only understand what's going on, but for once to feel it the way thousands and thousands and thousands of Mexicans have had to feel it. You have to be there. The kid's on the ground. The blood's pouring out of his head. He's just been executed. And the women are screaming because it's their son, their nephew. I've been there many times. And so I tried to bring it home for other people.
Charles, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Charles Bowden is the author of Dreamland, The Way Out of Juarez, illustrated by Alice Leora Brakes.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Brett Jaspers, and Michael Chapman. And we bid farewell to Peter Henderson. Thanks for all the hard work, and good luck with the job hunting, Peter. The show is edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson, and more engineering help from Ellis Traver.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.